everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got a trio of Costa Prize winners for you. Bart Van Es introduces us to his biography of The Cutout Girl.
At the heart of the story is this row that happened between Lean and my grandmother in the 1980s, which meant that Lean was no longer in touch with the Van Esses.
Hilary McKay reveals which real-life character inspired her children's book, The Skylark's War.
I did use Rupert, and I used Rupert Brooke's photograph as the rough description of my Rupert in the book, and I pinched his name.
And poet J.O. Morgan considers the four-minute warning in his Cold War epic, Assurances.
The warning is given, those few minutes granted, in which there is no action left to take. Only a moment, enough to contemplate.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. The Costa Book Awards recognise great writing across five categories: novels, first novels, children's books, poetry, and biography. The competition is open to authors living in Britain or Ireland and writing in English. The individual category winners were announced earlier this month, and next week one of them will be crowned Costa Book of the Year 2018. A couple of weeks ago, we heard from Stuart Turton, whose book The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle won the First Novel Award. If you missed it or any of our shows, you can download them all free from your favourite podcast provider. Now it's time to meet the winners of the other categories. First up, biography. Literary prizes can be acrimonious affairs, with disagreement among the judges sometimes eclipsing the book that wins. Not so in the biography category of this year's Costa Awards. The Cutout Girl was the unanimous choice of all the judges, who hailed it as the hidden gem of the year. And I'm delighted to be joined by its author, Bart Van Es. Congratulations and welcome to Read On. Now, the subtitle of the book is A Story of War and Family, Lost and Found. Could you explain to the listeners exactly why you chose that subtitle?
Well, the story is, first of all, one of the loss of family that so many people suffered during World War II. So it's the story of a Jewish girl, Lean, who went into hiding with my grandparents in 1942 in the Netherlands, and as a result of the Holocaust she lost all of her family pretty much. But Lean ended up staying with my grandparents after World War II and grew up with my father, in fact, but I had no memory of ever having met her. So it was only in 2014 that I, having always sort of known there was this family story of a girl who came to stay with the family, said, well, what happened to Lean? And so it was this experience of finding her again. At the heart of the story is this row that happened between Lean and my grandmother in the 1980s, which meant that Lean was no longer in touch with the Van Esses. So the story is a reconstruction of what happened during World War II, and also the story of Lean and my getting back together and the way in which we became close friends.
And that mystery really drives the narrative, of the present-day narrative, whilst you use Lean's diary, her Posy book, and family pictures to record what was happening during the Second World War.
Yes, that's right. So I tracked Lean down and first met her in December 2014. And she said, well, you know, we'll meet maybe for half an hour. She was rather reluctant. She said she didn't really feel any connection with the Van Esses anymore. But the meeting that was scheduled for half an hour ended up going on for 10 hours. I was still there late at night. And what happened was that gradually, as we felt this connection growing between us, she revealed all these documents that she actually still had about her in the flat, an incredibly powerful letter written by her mother, in which her mother gives up her daughter in the hope that she might survive the war, but also this Posy album. Almost all girls in the Netherlands used to keep these Posy albums, which are little poetry books where you get friends to write a poem and stick in some little cutouts. And so the Pussy album is one of the ways in which I reconstruct Lean's wartime experiences, because the poem book just starts with very simple things like her father writing a poem in 1940, her cousins and family putting things in, and then gradually my family starts coming into it, the Vanesses. And the final poem in the book, devastatingly, is actually from the one surviving relative of Auschwitz, Aunt Rosa, who briefly saw Lean in 1945 before going on to America.
It adds greatly to the poignancy of the story that she is a tiny little girl. She's 8 years old when her parents make the terrible decision to give her up to a foster family to save her life, because they know what's coming in the form of the Nazis rounding up the Jews.
Yes, so part of the book I decided to write in the present tense from Lean's perspective, almost as a novel, precisely because I think, you know, from her point of view, there was no sense of the war. There was no sense of the thing coming to an end in 1945. She just experienced all these things as without explanation. And those individual moments that are recorded in the Pussy album help to give that a kind of solidity, because they are just poems written to a little girl in the moment. So there's my Uncle Case, who just writes a kind of funny poem with a couple of rhymes about Monday and Tuesday in it, or my aunt appears in it. And those kind of moments then get kind of embedded in the narrative that Lean remembers. So, you know, she remembers just going to school. At times she was openly just going to school because she just took on another identity. At other times she was in hiding in bedrooms or in hideouts. So yeah, those individual documents help to root the story and give it that novelistic quality.
And you make the point that actually it was the Nazis who expressed her Jewishness. Her family were not religious, and it was only the fact that the Nazis made them sew on yellow stars and declare themselves as Jews that a girl with actually rather a Dutch name, Lien de Jong, became a Jew and became somebody who was persecuted.
Yes, I mean, one of the things I ended up reconstructing is how incredibly integrated Dutch Jews were. I mean, most Dutch Jews simply took Dutch surnames during the time of the Napoleonic occupation of the country. Lean's family were typical of that, and Lean thought of herself as entirely Dutch when she was a little girl living in The Hague. She concentrated on things like the Dutch Father Christmas, St. Nicholas, and that was very much the standard story of Dutch Jews, who had actually more rights than Jews anywhere in the world, particularly during the Dutch Golden Age. I mean, it was a place where lots of Jews fled, escaping persecution in the rest of Europe. And then that is twinned with this horrific fact that the fate of Dutch Jews was more terrible than that of any other Western group of Jews. You know, 80% of Dutch Jews were killed in the Holocaust, which is double that of Germany, for example.
Which just makes the resistance and help offered by your grandparents seem even more brave. It seems like Holland was a rather riven schizophrenic society in the 1940s, with people who were determined to help and people who were determined to collaborate.
Yeah, I mean, what happened in the Netherlands is, you know, the Germans took over after a very brief conflict of only 4 days. And they left the state entirely in place as it was. So there was still Dutch civil service, there were still Dutch policemen, the school system didn't change. And so the vast majority of people just outwardly accepted that. And the anti-Jewish measures were just ramped up imperceptibly. Little things, exclusion from air shelters, ban of Jews in the civil service, and then gradually the summonses to Poland. And by and large, the Dutch society just accepted that. It was the Dutch police who collected people. So I do have, you know, an incredible level of admiration for my grandparents to go against that, to put themselves and their family at enormous risk to take in fact, not just Lean, but a number of other Jewish children during the war. And my grandfather was very active in the resistance, also doing things like conducting raids on post offices in order to get ration stamps. But yeah, that was really the exception, particularly in 1942. Resistance increased over the course of the war, but early on, there were very few people who did very much.
As you said, because of an argument in the 1980s, Lean was, well, cut out of the family history, and you've managed to reintegrate her through researching this book, and I understand she's become very much a family friend.
Yes, absolutely. No, she'll be coming to the Costa Prize ceremony with me at the end of January, which will be a real joy. We're in touch pretty much every day at the moment, just sort of send her emails if I hear of a review of the book or somebody writes. But anyway, we are just good friends. She's come over to stay with us in Oxford a few times, and you know, we've seen her in Amsterdam. So, yeah, she feels to me as much family as anybody else. So that's been one of the enormous joys of the book, also getting to know her children, who are appreciative of the book too.
One of the lines that really stuck with me from the book is that getting to know Lean has changed me, which a lot of people might have said changed my life, but actually it's clearly changed your perceptions of bravery, secrets, and, well, refugees, I felt as well, reading the book.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such an astonishing privilege to have been able to follow somebody's life from its beginning. Not even the most intimate people in your life would you actually sit down with them, as I did with Lean, and say, you know, what are your earliest childhood memories? What was your bedroom like when you were small? What did you eat? What clothes did you wear? And through this month of interviews I did with her, I really asked her everything, and she totally opened herself up to me. And that gives you a degree of understanding of somebody else's emotional life that is very transformative. So for me, I think the biggest change in my personality was the ability to see someone else from the inside, and I hope it's made me a more empathetic person. It particularly kind of changed my insight into my own children, who, like all families, you have kind of moments of conflict with children, and suddenly just thinking, okay, how does it feel to be in a family and think at some point that you're not fully part of it, as Lean felt when she rejoined the Vanesses in 1945. I'd never really been able to see that, having come from a pretty privileged background. So that, and yes, understanding the fate of refugees, of also seeing modern Holland, which the book allowed me to do, because I went to look at all the places where Lean had lived during her life. And often that meant that I ended up meeting people who had very interesting stories to tell as well.
Yes, and the overwhelming feeling I got from the way you record Lean's words is that there was a sense of relief at finally being able to tell this story.
Yes, that's right. I mean, at the beginning, Lean was quite dismissive of her own story. And she said this sentence, which has become quite important in the book, when I said, I want to record your family story. And she said, well, without families, you don't have stories. And she said, well, you know, my story is typical of tens of thousands, millions of people. And she did once record it for the Shoah archive, and she did it in very basic terms. But what we ended up discovering between us, really, I think, is that she had an astonishing story to tell. And as she started reconstructing it, yeah, she found real release and pleasure in it. At a certain point, she actually sort of just said to me, I didn't realize I could speak about it for this long. So yeah, I wouldn't say that I had done anything terribly transformative in Lean's life. She had real problems, but she'd sorted herself out by the time that I met her. But she does take pleasure in the fact that the book has been recorded, that her family have gained a kind of existence in people's memory thanks to the Cutout Girl.
I wonder if maybe you'd approached Lean 10 years beforehand. Do you think you would have had the same conversation with her?
I think it would have been very different, certainly 20 years earlier. Mm. There was, in Lean's life, a very important moment in 2003 when she was finally able to visit Auschwitz. And she sees that as the moment at which she could really confront her past. But for much of her life, she'd really hidden from it and had actually been unable even to visualize for herself her parents or that whole world that she had around her, because it was just too terrifying. And then when she was finally able to visualize it, it was totally traumatic. And one of the things I'm interested in exploring in the book is that gradual process of unpeeling the layers of the past that she went through things like therapy and through conversations. And if I'd have met her in the 1990s, she would have been quite incapable of talking about it. She definitely says that herself. So I was, in that sense, lucky to meet her only in 2014.
Now, you're a professor of English at Oxford University, and your previous publications have been a book on Shakespeare's comedies and the Elizabethan poet Spenser. How different was it writing a biography? Did you find yourself using a whole different skill set?
Yeah, it was different and yet also a continuation, because if you study literature, of course, you're interested in techniques of literature. So I did try to write a literary book. You know, it uses techniques of the novel I've been interested in sharing with students over the years. And in certain ways, it also involved research like that, which I did for my Shakespeare books and my Spenser book. I spent quite a lot of time working in the Dutch police archives, for example, or in the archives of the Jewish fostering organization. But while it had that connection with my professional work in the past, it was also utterly different in the way that I was emotionally invested in this story. As you said, it's a story that was transformative for me personally. And being a middle-aged man and imagining yourself into the body and mind of a little girl is incredibly emotionally intense. And so the book was a kind of immersive experience for me. And it was difficult at times writing like that. I'm very glad I've done it. But there were moments at which I did think, what am I doing? Is this in any way a continuation of my professional career? I hope the books ended up being a kind of fusion of what an academic might do with this story and what a novelist might do, and then also what, you know, a father and a friend might have written about Lean.
Well, certainly at times I found myself pinching myself, thinking, hang on, this is fact. This isn't fiction. It reads in part like a very compelling novel. And I was wondering whether you felt any temptation to stray into fiction for your next work.
Yes, I have already the beginnings of a book which hopefully does kind of compare a bit with The Cutout Girl, which will be on one of Shakespeare's actors, Robert Armin, about whom I also have a lot of documents. And I'd like to think that there's a way in which you can combine the imaginative potential of the novel with doing archival research to give people that sense of the livingness of the past. Because I think if you just look at documents, these things can seem sort of terribly inanimate. Whereas what I tried to get in Lean's story by partly writing as a novel was to give the emotional depth, the limitedness of vision that you have when you're living in the moment in the way that she was. So I'm going to have a go at trying to do something a bit like that for Shakespeare's world as my next project.
I shall look forward to it. And rather joyously, for those of us who can't see, you actually narrated the audiobook version of The Cutout Girl, which, thanks to our relationship with Penguin Random House, should be entering the RNIB library very soon. Was it your own decision to narrate the book?
Yes, it was. I felt because it was such a personal book, partly also because it has some Dutch words in it, I would like to read it myself. I've always been a reader to my children. We carried on reading aloud far past the point at which my children could read themselves. So I wanted, if possible, to read it myself, and they gave me a trial and I passed the audition. So I was really pleased to be able to make the recording myself.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Almost all my family are addicts to audiobooks. Somehow I'm a bit more traditional. I like to sort of sit there in silence with a book, but maybe I should get converted. I think they are a great thing.
Well, I must say, it really was a treat to hear you reading your own work. I think many listeners would agree it's always better to hear the author's interpretation of their own words.
Thank you.
And, of course, you must be delighted to have won the biography category of the Costa Book Awards. Have you gone out and bought the other books that are now in line for the overall Costa Book Award?
Oh, my rivals. No, I haven't bought them yet, actually. I think I will. I mean, I only heard it on Tuesday, so it's just been a working week. But I think at the weekend, yeah, and hopefully the bookshops will have them all out there. They seem an amazing bunch of books. So, yeah, I very much look forward to that.
Well, it would be a wonderful end to Lean's story if you win the Costa Book Award and she's there in the same room as you. Bart Van Ez, thank you very much for appearing as a guest on Read On, and all the best of luck.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Without families, you don't get stories. The woman who tells me this stands making coffee in her apartment in Amsterdam. Her name is Heseline, Lean for short. She is over 80, and there is still a simple beauty about her. A clear complexion without noticeable makeup, a little silver watch but no other jewellery, and shiny, unpainted nails. She is brisk in manner, but also somehow bohemian, dressed in a long, dark grey cardigan with a flowing claret paisley scarf. Before today, I have no memory of ever having met her. All the same, I know that this woman grew up with my father, who was born in the Netherlands immediately after the war. She was once part of my family, but this is no longer the case. A letter was sent, and a connection was broken. Even now, nearly 30 years later, it still hurts Lean to speak of these things. From her white, open-plan kitchen, we move to the seating area, which is full of winter sunlight, filtered partly through stained-glass artworks that are fitted against the panes. There are books, museum catalogues, and cultural supplements spread beneath a low glass coffee table. The furniture is modern, as are the pictures on the walls. We speak in Dutch. You wrote in your email about being interested in the family history, and about maybe writing a book, she says. Well, the family thing doesn't really play for me. The Van Esses were important in my life for a long time, but not now. So what kind of writing do you do? Her tone is friendly, but also businesslike. I tell her a little about my work as a professor of English literature at Oxford University, writing scholarly books and articles on Shakespeare and Renaissance poetry. But she knows most of this already from the internet. So what is your motivation? She asks. My motivation? I'm not sure. I think hers could be a complex and interesting story. Recording these things is important, especially now, given the state of the world, with extremism again on the rise. There's an untold story here that I don't want to lose.
The Cutout Girl, written and narrated by Bart Van Ess, is available commercially and should be entering the RNIB library soon. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. This week we're focusing on the Costa Book Awards. Coming up later, J.O. Morgan discusses the link between war and poetry. But first, the winner of this year's Costa Children's Book Award is The Skylark's War by Hilary Mackay. Set against the backdrop of the First World War, it has attracted fans of all ages and was described by the judges as perfect a novel as you could ever want to read. Hilary Mackay, welcome to Read On and many congratulations on winning the 2018 Costa Children's Award.
Thank you so much. I'm absolutely thrilled with the news. I haven't quite believed it yet, but there we are.
You're still sitting down.
Yes.
So, for those who haven't yet read The Skylark's War, can you give us a brief synopsis?
Yes, it's a historical novel. It's set over a very long span of time. 1902 it begins, and it ends well into the 1920s, which is unusual for a children's novel. And it follows the lives of a group of young people growing up through the First World War, how it affected them and their families and friends, and out the other end. So it's half family, half historical. It does have some frontline trenches, points of view. It's a multi-point of view novel with five characters travelling together, as you might say. And so I tried to cover a lot of aspects in a very short book. I don't know. Maybe it should have been two books, actually. But anyway, that's a brief story.
And as you say, we do visit the trenches, but a lot of the story is told from Clary, your heroine's, point of view, and she's very much on the home front. And that's an aspect of the First World War that I think is too often forgotten.
Yes, but I can imagine, and I did imagine, how very bad it must have been for them with the dawning realisation of what they were sending people they loved into and how helpless they were to do anything to help them at all. Clary grows up and she grows with it, as it were. She starts off knowing nothing about it and at the end she knows everything about it. And I thought that was a different point of view to take. I can't write. I wasn't there. I don't know who has got the authority to write about what happened in the trenches, but I can write about how it feels to have something out of control happening to people that you care about very much, and how to deal with it with courage and grace, which is what I think she did. I really enjoyed writing it. It was the nicest book of my very long writing career.
As you say, the book starts before the First World War with Clary's birth in 1902. And I suppose the reader knows that the First World War will come 12 years later. So there's the impending sense of doom which overhangs the blissful summers that Clary and her brother Peter spend with their cousin Rupert, who is destined to go to the trenches.
Yes, you do have that foresight, don't you? But, you know, when I'm reading books set in that period, written in that period, I'm always thinking when those characters grow up, that's where they'll be, you know. And later, when you read, say, Swallows and Amazons, the Arthur Ransom books, you know that those boys are going to grow up and World War II will be on the horizon. So that's a foreknowledge that the reader has, but the characters, of course, don't have.
Are you very much influenced by the books of those periods? I was thinking there's quite an element of E. Nesbitt about the rather repressed childhood that Clary and Peter have with their father, who just really can't be bothered after their mother's death, and the freedom that they find with their grandparents in the glorious summer holidays down in Cornwall.
Yes, I am influenced by that period because I grew up reading those books. They were all about the house, my mother's books and my grandmother's books. We were very lucky to be brought up in such a reading household, and things were passed down the generations. So I was always interested in the period, and I read around it as well. Even as a little girl, I liked to know what was going on. I remember checking out Army and Navy Stores catalogues because they would have the prices and the clothes that people were wearing, that sort of thing. So it was an easy area for me to fall into and an easy time for me to think about.
And I read that the book actually took 5 years for you to write, which is even longer than the First World War itself. Was it very much a personal project?
I wrote other books in between. I had the characters in my head for 5 years. What I did was, a long time ago, I wrote a book that had a subplot 100 years earlier. And I very briefly wrote in about 5,000 words Skylark's story. But when I finished that book, I went on to write a few more. But always that set of characters were with me, and I was gradually doing a bit more research and acquiring a few things to go with it. And so it took me 2 years to write, actually. I'm a very, very slow writer. But yeah, it was with me for a lot longer. And then the 2018 centenary anniversary came up, and it seemed a good time to bring this story finally out to the world, and it's worked out quite well.
Did you feel that you could have carried on writing it for longer?
Oh, I could have made it a trilogy. I had so much more material. I would have loved to have done. But it would have got too long and too deep and so too self-absorbed. I think it worked better cut. I cut a lot out of it, but managed to keep the passage of time there, I think. I hope I did. And enough period details to make it solid. Yeah, it was a great pleasure to write. To be honest, the research was great fun.
I couldn't help wondering whether the character of Rupert was a nod towards the First World War poet Rupert Brooke.
Clever you, when I was 14, I still have the copy my mother bought me, Rupert Brooke's poems. He's well out of fashion now, I know. But he had a lovely way with words, and he was naively gung-ho about the war because he didn't know what he was getting into, like many of them didn't. So yes, I did use Rupert, and I used Rupert Brooke's photograph as the rough description of my Rupert in the book, and I pinched his name. So yeah, 10 out of 10 for that one.
One of the other things that comes out very strongly through the book is the importance or absence of education. Clary doesn't get to go to school because school is for boys like her brother and her cousin. And yet the education that the boys get doesn't prepare them at all for the horrors of the new century.
Well, it does in a way. It toughens them. They learn to live away from home. And a lot of them had some sort of military training in school. They used to do parade marching and things like that. Private schools and public schools did as part of their routine. So in that sense, they were used to dormitory life and managing without their families. I mean, the boys who went in as young officers, and they were the ones who were killed the most, actually, because they were the first over the top, statistically. as for girls' education, it was hit and miss. It was, if your parents were interested, it was available. And there were just beginning to be grammar skills built to give girls a decent education, but they were few and far between. You had to pass exams to get to them. And I found that there were 3 or 4 boys' schools to every girls' school that was funded for girls, which, you know, you just look at the number of girls born, it must have been much harder to get in and stay there. You must have had to have an interested family to get you there.
For girls, I suppose the education they received was very much from the books they could borrow, either from home libraries or public lending libraries. You yourself are a huge supporter of libraries, aren't you?
Oh, I am a huge supporter of libraries. I can't bear what's happening to our libraries. We kept libraries running through 2 world wars. My father educated himself in libraries. Libraries were the core of my childhood, my local library, and we weren't in a well-off area, but it was like a second home to me and to many, many other children. It was on the way to school, and it was as natural as going to the sweet shop on the way to school to duck into a library and change your library books, have a word with the librarian if she wasn't too busy. It was always there for us, and it horrifies me that my library now is 10 miles away. You have to drive there or get the transport, which doesn't exist. You can pay £10 to park if you want to spend an afternoon there. The local children do not have what I had 50 years ago, and I think it's iniquitous. That's what I think about libraries.
We have the First World War, of course, to thank for the creation of audiobooks.
I wondered if you'd mentioned that, you know. It had such an influence on medical treatment in many fields, didn't it? And that was one of them. A lot of help for blind people started with the treatment of soldiers back from the trenches.
Yeah, absolutely. And had it not been for so many soldiers losing their sight because of gas, there would not be any R&IB talking books now.
Is that fact? That's very interesting.
Well, yes, it was due to the hard work of Ian Fraser, who actually began work on how to put books onto long play records so that blinded soldiers would be able to listen to them. We at the RNIB are very fortunate to have our own library full of accessible books.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that The Skylark's War has already been made into an audiobook, which hopefully will be entering the RNIB library very soon. You must be delighted that through audiobooks you're reaching an audience that might otherwise be print disabled.
Oh, I am so pleased. My own daughter is dyslexic. I have friends with dyslexic children, and it helps them as well as visually impaired people. I used to have a great friend, and it used to be my weekly job to collect her audio books and her audio newspapers and post them back again, and it was an absolute lifeline to her and a great joy to her. So yes, it's an honour. I'm delighted.
Have you found that you've changed the way you write at all, knowing that your books are now more likely to be made into audiobooks than ever before?
No, I haven't. And I'll tell you why. Because when I write, it's very much an audio thing with me. I read it aloud over and over again to make sure it scans. I think I read The Skylarks, I'm not exaggerating, 20 times before I sent it in. If I change a word, I go back and read the paragraph. And if I change a paragraph, I go back and read the pages each side. So it's very much written with a view to audio, because that's the way I work. It's the only way I can get rhythm and the sentences and the echoes taken out and things like that. So I think I am very audio sensitized, for want of a better way of putting it anyway.
I know that you grew up with 3 younger sisters. I wondered whether you told them stories when you were growing up.
No, I didn't have to. They were great readers. We took 16 books a week out of our library, and we ran out by Wednesday and went back and swapped them. We were always reading. They didn't need stories telling. But my father was a great storyteller. He would tell us stories. He would make them up. He could stop a room with his storytelling. It was a gift that he had. So we did have stories told to us, but we were also readers.
It's not the first time that you've been a winner. Is it equally exciting to be a winner a second time?
It's better this time. It's better because I put my heart into this book, because social media exists, and so I can see much more quickly. When the last book won, it was 15 years ago. It's funny how the world has changed. You got your reviews by paper. now they come immediately online, and you can see how people are reacting to what you've written. It makes it all more immediate and real. And it's come later in my career. And I think I'm not as green as I was. I can see that it means a lot to a lot of people besides me. So I think, yeah, it's better this time.
And will you be sitting down to read the other four category winners?
Oh, I've got them. Yes, they're brilliant. Candy Gorlow's book is absolutely wonderful. And David Almond, of course, is a gem. He always is. And Matt's book is also a great reading. I've got them all and read them all ages ago.
And do you read the other categories as well, such as the biography and the poetry? Or are you first and foremost a children's book fan?
No, I'm an all sorts of books fan. I haven't read the others, but that's laziness and not getting around to it. I will read the others. I'd especially like to read the poetry. But yeah, I will read them. I just haven't done it yet.
Well, you've got a few weeks yet. And again, very, very many congratulations on winning the children's book category. And thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you very much indeed.
The Skylark's War by Hilary Mackay. Read by Catherine Press. More than 100 years ago, in the time of gas lamps and candlelight, when shops had wooden counters and the streets were full of horses, a baby girl was born. Nobody was pleased about this except the baby's mother. The baby's father did not like children, not even his own, and Peter, the baby's brother, was only 3 years old and did not understand the need for any extra people in his world. But the baby's mother was pleased. She named the baby Clarissa, after her own lost mother. "Clear and bright," she whispered to her brand new baby. "That's what your name means. Clear and bright. Clary."
The Skylark's War is published in print and ebook and as an audiobook narrated by Catherine Press.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios would come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bookingtook?
Bookingtook, yeah. It's Booking a new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake. And if...
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. In its 47-year history as first the Whitbread and now the Costa, the Book of the Year Award has been won by a poet on 8 occasions. Most recently, last year, by Helen Dunmore for her posthumous collection Inside the Wave. This year, the Costa Poetry Award went to J.O. Morgan for Assurances. It's a long-form poem running to just under 50 pages that reflects on the threat of mutually assured nuclear destruction during the Cold War. The judges were gripped and dazzled by its originality and inventiveness.
J.O. Morgan, welcome to Read On.
Hello there, Red. Thank you for having me on the show.
So, the foreword to Assurances mentions that your father was part of the airborne nuclear deterrent during the Cold War, which gives us a hook to hang our thoughts upon. And from there, you take the poem through the lives of various people, all of whom are living under the threat of assured nuclear destruction. It's quite a symphony, as far as the poem is concerned. Lots of different strings coming in to play variations on the same theme.
Well, thank you. You described it really nicely there. You've done my job for me. And symphony and variations, yes, that was sort of the approach I had for it. I mean, the idea for doing something on that subject had been in my thoughts for many years because of my father's involvement, and I thought it was a fascinating subject. But I didn't quite know how to approach it. And it was a long time ago that he was involved, because it was only really the airborne nuclear deterrent, only for about 4 years or so, at the very beginning, in 59 to 63, I think, you had V-Force involved, which were these Vulcan bombers. And that was what my father was involved with at that time. But it was only in recent years that I had this completely separate idea, not connected to any subject, of maybe trying to see how the musical form of a theme and variations might work in a literary manner. You know, it'd be very different from how it would work in music. And these two thoughts are floating around completely separately until a few years ago I joined them together and thought that might work for this subject. You know, the theme being the rationale behind this terrible thing of mutually assured destruction, which should nonetheless keep us safe, this stalemate of saying if you send missiles at us, we will send missiles back, and then nobody wins, everybody loses. So that's the rationale, that's the theme. And then these many different variants and possibilities and imagined scenarios, because of course the bomb never was dropped, thankfully, which is why we're still talking. But in the book, I'm able to look at that possibility, and I'm able to look at it from different angles, from different people that are aware of the threat, people that go on blissfully through their lives not really thinking about it, people involved in the deterrent. I hope that there's a lot of complexity and variation within it, and yet, for the reader, it should carry them along. They shouldn't feel like, where am I now? Hopefully, because of knowing that theme, knowing the scenario, you're sort of within that story all the time. You know where you are with it.
We're of a similar age, and certainly growing up, it was the fact that everybody knew and that none of us really wanted to discuss. It was, I suppose it was the great unifying idea of the second half of the 20th century. The entire world knew that this threat hung over us and it was out of our control. Some people buried their heads and some people went on marches. It struck me that whilst it's still a very present threat, we've forgotten something since the Berlin Wall came down.
Yes, I think we have. Certainly, exactly from that time, I suppose in the thoughts of many people, it's fine, it's over now. But the nuclear missiles are still there. They haven't got rid of them. I think I saw a statistic. I think the UK, well, I don't know if this is up to date, but the UK has, say, 200 nuclear missiles. I mean, how many do you need? But I was going to say USSR, that takes you back a bit. Russia has around about 7,000, and the US have around about the same amount. I mean, just extraordinary numbers of these nuclear missiles that are just there. So the threat is always there. And I suppose the deterrent had to exist merely because these bombs existed. How do you defend against something like that? You can't. It's too big a thing. So you can only defend against it by a counteracting threat. But you're right. Somebody was talking to me recently about the idea of the term Cold War. And he was saying, and I think it is a term, it sounds a bit strange because we're not used to it, of hot peace, which is sort of what we're in at the moment. The idea that we're supposed to be in peacetime, but the hotness corresponds to the sort of chaotic nature of it. in the Cold War, we were supposedly in a war scenario, but the coldness refers to it being very ordered. It was controlled. Everyone knew where they stood. But this peacetime where we're not quite sure of the rules anymore. We've just had the Russian leader, Putin, talking about the stealth missiles that they're developing. And you think, how does that help in terms of the deterrent? That's a further provocation. And then, of course, we've got Korea and we've got America and we've got all these things. And there's uncertainty. It feels that there is more of this uncertainty. And we don't quite know if everyone understands the rules of not engaging, of not provoking. So it is an odd time. And the curious thing was, as I was working on this book, thinking about it over a few years, these more modern or recent situations weren't so evident. And it was really just as I was finishing the words, you know, putting the words down for the book, which is a couple of years ago now, I just started hearing these things in the news a bit more. So it was just after the new U.S. president. And then, of course, we had the general election here, and our own prime minister herself was saying she would press the button, whereas the leader of the opposition was saying he thinks unilateral disarmament would be bigger. And I was hearing all these things, and I'd just written this work, and I was thinking, this is sort of, even though I'm talking about it in the end of the 50s, it's still relevant, and it should be the same principle to hopefully keep us safe. And I didn't want my work to be a work of doom and gloom. Oh, we're all going to go off in a big fireball. I wanted it to have that sense of positivity within the chaos of this stalemate, or in the craziness of this stalemate. And that's why I chose the word assurances for the title, because I wanted it to have this sense of positivity. You could see it ironically as well. It's a strange assurance to have. We'll all go together as we go. No, we'll all go together when we go, I think is what Tom Lehrer sang in the 60s. But yes, it is an odd time, certainly, to be living in. And maybe those thoughts are coming back to the public consciousness.
During the poem, you give a voice to the bomb itself. And there are plenty of references to mechanisms and machinery throughout the poem. It's almost as if there is a constant countdown, 4-minute warning going through the entire poem. Was that a conscious decision, or was it something that just kept coming back within your writing of the poem?
I think you've described it really well there. I mean, it's probably better than I would. I probably would have waffled on for ages. But I think there really is that sense of resetting. The idea I certainly wanted to portray was a sense of waiting. If you're one of the airmen involved or one of the crew or whatever, the military enforcing or maintaining this deterrent, this sense of waiting that you are part of a machine yourself, you are part of a mechanism, a system that's in place. And this is why I often use the word chaotic, because there's so many different aspects involved. It was a mechanism made up of people and machines. So decisions would have to be made. Real people would have to be sending messages and receiving those messages, coded messages, and actually flying the bomb to its destination, because in those years, it wasn't a ballistic missile. It was a gravity bomb. And this is why you had the Air Force. They'd actually have to fly in and deliver it pretty much on spot. So that is another sort of perilous idea, that this is your job. This is what you're highly trained to do. You'd really rather not do it. But if it comes to it, you have to do it. And if that order comes through, the whole aspect of the deterrent is it has to be done. We have to retaliate. The enemy has to know that we will respond. Otherwise, it's not a deterrent. If they think we're going to go and say, actually, no, I prefer not to kill millions of people with retaliation, the deterrent is lost. So I think there were three principles to the deterrent, one of which was it had to be automatic. So, you know, even though it was people involved in it, it would be done. It had to be immediate, so no hanging around, and it had to be overwhelming, all of which are rather frightening. But that had to be the thing. So yes, the mechanism of that process, and of course using these machines, the bomb itself, the aircraft, the decoding equipment in the aircraft, all chattering away, all these things going on all at once, plus the individuals that sort of become like cogs in the machine, but thinking cogs. And many of the variants throughout the work look at aspects of when those little cogs might fail. One little cog, one person saying, no, I don't want to do this. Or everything running smoothly, you know, that other possibility, and what that entails, or how that would resolve. But that idea of the countdown, when you said that, it made me think of this word reset, as though each new day it's resetting, the same thing again. So it's a countdown, yes. But every new day or every new shift, perhaps the airmen go on to do their manoeuvres, that countdown begins again.
As we've discussed, it's a poem that commemorates a war that never happened. It felt like a companion piece to your earlier poem, At Maldon, which is a translation of the Anglo-Saxon poem of the Battle of Maldon. In that, you commemorated everybody who had died, and in this, you commemorated everybody who survived. Were they written as companion pieces?
I certainly did have that feeling as I was writing this one. I remember when I was writing At Maldon that even though I have many modern allusions, because though it's not so much a translation of the old original poem, it sort of uses the original Anglo-Saxon, although I did translate that for myself, I then use that sort of a basis, almost like that was a document. It wasn't a document, of course, it was a poem, and how much can we actually trust it? But that's the only document we have for those events on that day. So I was looking at that aspect, and I was using a lot of modern references, because it was a modern poem for a modern audience. You know, I'm telling it now rather than 1,000 years ago. But within that, I remember specifically staying away from modern military allusions. And even at that time, I just had a feeling in the back of my mind that maybe at some point I will do a modern warfare book. And I think I had this scenario in mind. But back then, I still didn't quite know how I would do it, so it was just a vague thought. But certainly when I started writing Assurances, yes, I was aware of the comparisons, and I wanted them to work as sort of, as you say, companion pieces, or as I've been thinking, sister works to each other. They both deal with defence. You know, Maldon is the force in Essex defending against the Viking invaders. They're forced into that position of confrontation, because if they don't defend, well, then the Vikings will just come in and it'll be a walkover. And similarly here, this is a situation where it's a standoff. It's trying to say, we don't actually want to fight. Can we do it a different way? Can we do this? Can we create this stalemate where no shots are fired, essentially, but the tension is still there, the trigger is ready to be depressed?
I know that you recorded parts of At Maldon for the Poetry Archive. Are there any plans for Assurances to be made into an audio version?
There aren't as yet. And actually, for At Maldon, it was the whole thing. I did the whole work for the Poetry Archive. It was really lovely when they contacted me and they wanted me to record something for the archive. And I was keen at that time. I said, can we do the whole work? I prefer, if I'm going to present something to anyone, I want it to be the whole thing, which is tricky when you do long poems that last about an hour to read. But they were really keen on that. For Assurances, there are no plans as yet. But I was just chatting to a friend of mine last night who's a filmmaker and who's looking to branch into sound recordings. And I was saying, let's give it a go. Let's try something. I was hoping that rather than doing a straight recording, we could use a lot of background soundscapes, or nothing too much, but just the idea that it would become a little bit more like a dramatic rendition of the work. Because there are lots of different voices that come into play, lots of different perspectives. I thought we could just, you know, adjusting the levels to give a different sense of who's talking here, and rather than me having to change my voice or do silly accents, because I don't want it to sound like a gimmick. So no plans, but certainly thoughts.
Well, I know there are a lot of print-disabled listeners, such as myself, who would love to hear you reading the entire poem. But in the meantime, I know you very kindly recorded an excerpt for us.
Yes, yeah, so this is, it's very difficult to take out extracts from a large piece. But this is one of the instances, there are a few of them, a few variations on the idea of the four-minute warning in the work. And this is the first of them. It's actually only a small extract from that. And it just looks at an individual, an unnamed individual, who's heard that warning through radio, most likely. And 4 minutes doesn't really give much time to do anything. So it was just a little example of somebody who might hear it and then what they do in the next few minutes.
She's sitting alone in the strip-lit glare of her kitchen when the news breaks, interrupting morning prayers, and the warning is given, those few minutes granted, in which there is no action left to take, only a moment enough to contemplate. So she leaves the coffee cooling, the half-buttered toast to go soft, and steps outside to welcome in the dawn. Her barefoot prints bend back the grass, the weight of one thing pressing down to overwhelm another, and yet leaving it unharmed, the fine green blades rewoken by their springiness, unsticking themselves from themselves as from the burdens placed upon them.
J.O. Morgan, thank you so much for reading that extract from Assurances, and many congratulations on winning the 2018 Costa Poetry Award, and best of luck in the Book Awards at the end of the month.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It was lovely talking to you.
Assurances by J.O. Morgan is out now in paperback and ebook. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, when we will, of course, bring you the result of who has won the 2018 Costa Book Award. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.